Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm Yaro Spencer, and I am joined by my co-host, a man on a real search for gold, Michael Hinderocker.
Yeah, it sounds so...
It's true. Come on.
It sounds good or bad.
You can't be ambivalent about every intro I give you. Like, at this point, you are on the path to try and get gold.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'd like to get gold. If I don't get silver, something went, like, really wrong. Like, plane crash kind of wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you have half of a season left, and you're at, like, 17 points locked.
Yeah.
So you need not very many.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm really excited for you. Congratulations, finally, on getting that top 16 after many disappointing finishes in a row. Disappointing not being your record as much as... Disappointing.
Yeah, I just was like bad at getting good tie breaks, but not quite good enough tie breaks.
Yeah, but this time you got there.
Yeah. So the 7-0 start does help your tie breaks.
Yeah. So congratulations to you, Michael, this weekend. You know who will never mess with your tie breaks is our sponsors. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. Get 15% off of your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. You can get 4% off of every order by using the code WouldThatBeGood at checkout. You can also check out our other sponsor at the Mana Base, where you can watch the Mason Crusher and Nikachu, the Merfolk Master himself, and a ton of other awesome content creators. We really appreciate both of our sponsors, whether it's Oasis Games trying to get your Magic singles, or whether it's the Mana Base just trying to support local, not even local, but just like overall Magic content creation. And, you know, giving us an outlet as well as a little bit of store credit to Fusion Gaming. You can check out Fusion Gaming, their sponsor, to get all of your sealed products. So thank you so much, to both of our sponsors. And don't forget to get the rest of the network. You can check out Constructive Criticism, which is this show, limited time only, our limited podcast. Proving Combatants, a podcast that I think is currently bi-weekly by Chantel and her co-hosts about... competitive Magic through the lens of female competitive Magic players. It's a super awesome podcast. Check it out. And also, we have two new hosts for Common Knowledge, a popular podcast about getting better at Magic the Gathering. We're currently in conversations about where we want the show to go, how we want it to do, things like that. So the network is definitely growing, as well as articles, a weekly finance article. And then my YouTube video. So the network is definitely growing. We really appreciate everybody. If you want to support that directly, go to patreon.com/ccmtg to support this show. And it's fun to watch this website grow and the people that are a part of it. You know, it's really cool. So let's move on to our first segment, which is hashtag always improving. Before we do that, don't forget to support the podcast directly by going to patreon.com/ccmtg. But the point of the show is hashtag always improving. We believe if you aren't getting better, you're getting worse. We want to be doing what we can all the time to be trying to improve ourselves. Michael, what did you do this week to improve at Magic the Gathering?
I just kind of stuck with the deck I was playing, and I changed a couple of things I thought made it a little bit better. And just ground it out. The deck was good. I lost a couple of tricky matchups and, you know, just recognized there's not much to do but keep playing and managed to win the last couple, get that X3, which is really valuable. Was really happy with how things went this weekend overall.
Well, I'm glad. I think that keeping an even keel mind after a couple of finishes that, like, cost you a lot of money, to be honest. Like, there's no pretending that that didn't happen. And just being able to keep an even mind going into your next event is pretty powerful.
Sure, yeah. I mean, but ultimately, like, you don't really have control of your own tiebreakers, so...
You don't.
Really anything to do about it.
You don't, but it's really easy to get caught up in that, right? Where, like...
Yeah.
At some point, like, it's too easy to be caught in a death spiral, even when the death spiral isn't necessarily your fault, or even if you had anything to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you would rather have things break your way when it comes to tiebreakers, but ultimately, like, it doesn't change how you play it. It shouldn't really change too much how you feel about yourself. So I was feeling pretty good about where I was in this format going into this weekend, and I was happy to just sort of play a Grand Prix where I felt really comfortable with what I was playing and what I was playing against.
That's super fair. So for me this weekend, I also went to GP Portland, and I had my worst constructed GP of all time. But I think that I had a really big improving moment this weekend in that I think it was round five where I lost game three, and I had one of my CC Worldwide teammates. So I have a new testing team, CC Worldwide, with a few players around the world who were trying to share information and stuff. And one of my teammates comes up to me after my match, and he's like, I'm pretty sure you could have won that game if you sequenced it this way. And at this point, I had only kept 1-7 throughout the entire event, and I was feeling pretty unlucky. And I thought to myself, oh man, like, did I get so caught up in my bad luck that I was playing poorly? And I think after this player came up to me and talked to me about it, I realized that it was true, in that I had gotten caught up in my own narrative to spin the story of my tournament a certain way, rather than taking each individual match on its own merits. So every time I mulliganed, it became a story about how much I was mulliganing, rather than the correct decision that I made to try and win my match in front of me.
Yeah, I think that's like an interesting thought, just like that sometimes we kind of let our emotions and how we feel about what's happening get in the way of just like making the best decision at each point going forward.
Yeah.
And sort of that, like, no matter how lucky or unlucky you are, if, you know, you're really lucky and you're playing really loosely because of it, or if you're really unlucky and you're just sort of, you know, feeling defeated before you've lost, both of those can kind of come back to bite you a little bit.
Well, and I think that, like, we kind of talked about this in the car after day one, but I think pretty often what happens to people in general is their bad luck is magnified by their misplays. So what happens is you are, in fact, getting unlucky. But because you are getting unlucky, your misplays, like, get hidden under that bad luck.
Well, yeah, I think what I would say is, like, when you're getting unlucky, you lose every game that you make misplays in.
Oh, absolutely.
You can't afford anything going wrong on your side.
You can't. So, like, what happens is you get to spin the narrative that you got unlucky rather than the fact that, like, maybe you played a little bit garbo for a couple of turns there.
Right.
And what in really fact happened
was the margin got narrow.
Right. The margin of victory just got so much smaller that when you decided to go ahead and make those misplays, you lost equity that you had before that round started, or even before you made those plays. And then it's really easy to tell yourself, well, I lost this game because of my bad luck. But, like, well, did you? Like, what actually happened? You were, in fact, unlucky, but had you played correctly, would that bad luck not have mattered?
Right.
And I do think that I played relatively poorly this weekend. And when you combine playing pretty bad with being pretty unlucky, like, you're going to lose a lot of matches.
Yeah, no, it can definitely just snowball on you a little bit where all of a sudden you've lost a couple of your own, and it's just hard to get your head back in the game.
Yeah. I mean, a really good example of, like, Michael and I talked about this play a little bit, but I was X3, I was playing against Mono Red, and I was going to reanimate my Rogue Refiner end of turn with my Scarab God, and my opponent discarded a Hazoret to his Hazoret. And I was like, well, this is way better. Like, I just get to block his Hazoret for free for the whole game. So I just activated and animated his Hazoret. Right after I did that, I thought, wait a second. I have three cards in hand. What am I doing? And it's like, yeah. I could have decided to make that play had I just played, like, the big mana card in my hand first, then, you know, proceeded to make the game. Like, that is a line that eventually I probably do take, but it didn't have to be at that second, and it certainly wasn't correct at that second. And I think that what happens is, like, you try and ignore those moments where you clearly made the mistake when you're being unlucky, or when you're getting unlucky, I should say. And I think that's just not correct. Like, you have to take all of it. It's a holistic approach to Magic that we have to take if we're going to try and get better.
Yeah, definitely.
So, well, let's go on to our next segment, which is our power rankings. So every week on the show, we want to talk about just one of the constructed formats and give you an idea of, like, what's going on in it. This week, we're going to use MTGO to talk about our legacy format. This is a format that I know that a lot of people love. It's not getting a lot of love from Wizards, but we're going to give it some love. And we're going to talk about the number 5 deck that comes in with 419% or 4.19% of the meta, and that's lands. So, Michael, dude, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know. This deck is one that I thought would be one of, if not the best decks, pretty early after Pop was banned. What's going on here?
So, it's a little bit tricky. Like, your combo matchups are just awful, and there's no way around that. Like, you don't play any real main deck disruption. You can sort of, like, try to fast combo yourself, but it's not reliable, and right. It's just generally, like, your combo matchups are pretty abysmal. So, if combo is well-positioned, this deck is really bad. But this deck absolutely smashes the, like, Grixis and four-color decks. Like, fair decks that are trying to, like, Deathrite Shaman and Delver and Leovold or whatever, like, those cards just don't do anything.
Sure.
You just don't matter. Like, not even a little bit. It's really, really hard for those decks to beat a bunch of Wastelands and Punishing Fires and 2020s.
Yeah, I think in a world of, like, Delvers and Leovolds, this deck looks pretty good.
Yeah, like, this deck has bad matchups for sure, and it's a little bit more of a metagame deck than some of the more, like, fair blue decks, where, I mean, your matchups are a little bit less polarized, but I think that, like, if you're expecting a lot of Delver and a lot of Checkpile, this deck is really, really good in those matchups.
A lot of people say this deck is super hard to play between Gamble and Crop Rotation and, you know, the type of games that you end up playing. What are your opinions on, like, how tough this deck can be?
My impression, having not played a lot of lands, is that it's mostly about being able to, like, identify the lines that are correct early in the game based on the information you get about your opponent's deck. So sort of deciding when you can take a more conservative approach and, like, play to sort of Punishing Fire versus when you really need to, like, try to set up an aggressive waste lock versus when you need to aggressively try to make 2020s. And I think that, like, a lot of that just comes with experience. I don't get the impression that the games are super divergent. Like, a lot of the games that you're winning are playing out very, very similarly, but being able to identify sort of how you're going to win the game quickly enough that you're not wasting resources on a dead game plan is really important.
Coming up next with 4.75% of the meta, we have 4-color Loam. This deck, calling this 4-color Loam is super interesting to me because, like, it's kind of a mashup between Loam decks and, like, kind of those mid-rangey Knight decks in general.
This is, like, halfway between Lands and Maverick is what
It's kind of how I think of it, too. What do you think that, like, it's pretty close to Maverick, like, between the two of them. But it is a Chalice of the Void Mox Diamond deck that gets to play creatures, which is kind of like an in-between of the two, kind of what you were saying.
Yeah, it's a little bit different than Maverick in that you're not quite playing so many just dudes.
Sure.
You're much more focused on, like, this is sort of a true control kind of prison deck. Sometimes they'll play, like, Dark Depths, but these days that seems to have fallen out of favor, and instead it's a pretty pure control deck.
I think that the inclusion of things like Garruk Relentless out of the sideboard in some of these decks kind of tells you where this deck is lying, at this moment, which is that it is like a mid-rangey control deck that you that its main game plan is in fact Knight of the Reliquary Punishing Fire, just trying to gain an edge in the fact that it's not trying to draw extra cards against Leovold, so it can just be go a little bit bigger, a little bit more consistent, maybe play a few Dark Confidants for card advantage that doesn't interact.
Yeah, you have some card advantage engines. You're also just fairly good at removing Leovold. The guy who I usually follow most when it comes to this deck is the user Matzel. I don't know how he would like his name pronounced, but he has had pretty consistent results with his deck on Magic Online over an extended period of time with a variety of differing builds and
a variety of different planeswalkers in his sideboard, to be honest.
Well, and sometimes the main deck, like sometimes the Ajani Vengeance creeps into the main deck, sometimes the Tabernacle's in the main deck, but like he very clearly has an idea of what he's doing and why. And my impression, at least, is that against a lot of the Leovold decks, you're a fairly good just attacking deck. Like a Knight of the Reliquary or a Scavenging Ooze can often just outgrow some of the threats in those decks. Yeah. And in combination with Wasteland and the ability to, you know, occasionally set up Loam or Punishing Fire sequences to keep them from casting a Leovold at all, you're just good at keeping them off balance.
Do you think that the decrease in the number of Swords to Plowshares you might expect to play against on average gives this deck an advantage that it didn't have before?
Maybe a little bit. I think that in general this deck had sort of okay, like, mid-rangey blue matchups just because Chalice tends to be pretty good there. But it would definitely rather play against Grixis Delver. Matchups where Punishing Fire is actually good are just inherently going to be much easier.
So coming up next, we have Miracles with 5.3% of the meta. Dude. Like, it did 6-0 the Legacy Challenge, so let's give it that. But what do you think, man? Like, is this deck still as bad as you and I think it is?
I mean, I actually like this deck pretty well.
Do you like no Monastery Mentor, or do you like Monastery Mentor?
I prefer it in the main deck, but I think a lot of it is preference. You see a lot of people playing Gideon over it in the main deck. But I think that, like, ultimately, this is just one of those shells where, like, it's sort of a purer Snapcaster Mage deck than, like, the four-color Leovold deck. If you think for whatever reason that, like, either you just don't like Deathrite Shaman or you think that there's a reason to expect a lot of hate for Deathrite Shaman, I think this deck is, like, a little bit better against Chalice than some of these other decks. I mean, I see someone playing main deck Supreme Wills in one of the lists from
that. Did you see the 12th place list from the Constructed portion of the team event that was playing 3 Search for Azkanta?
Yeah, that's Anurag. So he's really good, and he's played Predict Miracles basically for the last few years. I think 3 searches is interesting, and that, like, that would be maybe your main incentive to lean away from Monastery Mentor.
That was the first thing I noticed was the no Monastery Mentors and then the Search for Azkantas.
So I think that, like, maybe those in combination would give you some better game against Leovold, specifically because it's not drawing cards, but it's allowing you to play slightly fewer. Like, he's not playing 4 Portents, although Portent works out okay sometimes against Leovold. And I think that, like, in general, this deck lines up probably better than you'd think in those matchups. Having all of the red blasts in the boarded games is really powerful against those decks. But it's hard for me to say this deck is better than 4-color Leovold, but it's very different. It's much more of a pure control deck rather than kind of a mid-rangey deck.
Yeah. Let's actually go to our next deck, which has a huge drop-off compared to the last time we talked about Legacy. 4-color comes in with 8.66%. And honestly, Michael, I'm a little bit worried about inbreeding and that could be the reason this deck is falling off.
Yeah, a little bit. I think people have also figured out some stuff with relation to building Rixis Delver to be better in this matchup specifically. I think that's one of the big reasons. But I also do think that, like, as people are more aware, Hymn to Turok is, like, the best 2-drop in this deck by a substantial margin, but as people become more and more aware of it, you're punished more and more for leaning heavily on it.
Yeah.
And I just think, in general, this deck, although it's really powerful, it has, like, a pretty bad mana base. It's very reliant on Deathrite Shaman. And if people figure out cards that maybe aren't quite so bad against Leovold, like Search for Azkanthus-style cards to help draw, like, there are just all kinds of little edges that people can find. And I don't think this deck is infallible, right? It's very powerful, but ultimately, it's just a pile of good cards.
Yeah, and I think that, like, the deck getting the name pile kind of speaks for itself, in that it's a very Jundi blue deck, right? Where, like, you get rewarded for playing Deathrite Shaman, playing good creatures, right? Belvoir Strike, Snapcaster Mage, Leovold, and then just trying to kind of grind them out between those incremental advantages. And I think that when you're trying to beat the mirror in the incremental advantage mirror, it lends itself to maybe losing a little bit of an edge against other decks, even the matchups that are supposed to be really great for you, like Delver.
Yeah, I really do think that the Delver decks specifically have sort of found something in the last couple of weeks. We can talk about that momentarily.
Yeah. Let's actually go on to our number one deck, which is Rixis Delver, making up a whopping 14.8% of the meta online right now. These decks are basically all pretty similar, though.
Yeah, so one of the things that a lot of the Rixis Delver players are starting to do, and I think that I want to credit, I believe, Bob Huang, I don't know that he started this, but has sort of popularized it, is moving away from both Stifle and Cabal Therapy in the main deck and leaning more on Spell Pierce.
That's not what I'm seeing.
Those are lists that have had the most success in paper.
So I know that Cabal Therapy is kind of in or out, but it looks like most lists are in fact running Young Pyromancer main again.
No, so they're playing, they've all played, they play Pyromancer whether or not they play,
whether or not they're playing any of the other,
yeah. That's just part of the deck, regardless. But the Spell Pierces in the main help you a lot against check pile specifically, because one of the problems with Cabal Therapy is that they're not really reliant on a single card or engine. So trying to just guess, like, without a Gitaxian Probe specifically, it's just very weak in the matchup. Sure. And leaning on Spell Pierce instead, you're forcing them to spend their mana, and then you're beating them on mana efficiency, rather than trying to strip their best cards, because often they'll end up in these situations like an Abrupt Decay, a K Command, a Snapcaster, and a Leovold, right? And, like, unless you have a Gitaxian Probe and a Young Pyromancer, your Cabal Therapy is just going to be very weak. Where, so if you have a Spell Pierce, you force them to play into your mana and then can punish them for having worse mana.
It looks like both the third and fourth place decks from the Classic this weekend were a Young Pyromancer Cabal Therapy deck, but it does look like online Spell Pierce is more relevant. So where
the fifth place deck was playing Spell Pierce, like, it's something that had been really rare until, like, the
I think the fifth place list is literally an exact.
Yeah, I think it's just Bob Huang's list.
Yeah, I think it's just literally the same list as some of those other 5-0s online.
Yeah, the sixth place, or the eighth place, rather, is also with Spell Pierces. And I think that, like, it's weaker in the combo matchups and some of the other matchups in the main deck, but being good against 4-color online especially is really, really important. And I think that that little change specifically has really flipped that matchup a little bit. And you still, I mean, obviously, these decks are still playing Cabal Therapy in the sideboard. It's not like they're not playing any of these and they're 75. They're just making main deck choices specifically for the 4-color matchup.
Okay. So, Michael, what would you play and why in Legacy right now?
It's hard to say. So, like, with these team events coming up in the next couple of months. Probably looking at playing. I certainly wouldn't mind playing like Grixis Delver.
Sure.
Maybe I'll probably mess around a little bit with like Grixis Delver, Rug Delver, and some combo variants. If I don't play one of those, I'd be surprised.
I was texting Matt Kling today. He was asking me, like, do you have a preference on format that you want to play for Santa Clara? And I was like, not really. Like, I've played less Legacy recently than I typically do. Modern is my highest win percentage format, but, like, basically whatever you and Michael want to play, just plug yourselves into, and then I'll practice the other thing. And, like, it's not like I don't know how to play Legacy, right? Like, I've played a lot of 4-color Leovold. I've played a lot of Grixis Delver. I've played a lot of 4-color Loam style decks, things like that. So if, like, we want to play a mid-range deck, like, I'm all for it. But I don't know where I sit in Legacy right now.
Yeah.
The 4-color Leovold decks honestly feel like they're getting a little bit inbred. And if I were to build the deck, like, if I, like, probably were to put on my deck list, I would probably look at it and think, like, why am I making certain card choices, and is it because the
it's hard to feel like you're not either being inbred or underprepared for the mirror.
Yeah.
And that feels like maybe it's the sign of a deck that, like, in the next 2 weeks, I don't really want to mess with.
That's my thought also. So, like, if it were me, I would probably play something a little bit closer to 4-color Loam, where I can make some more reasonable choices.
Yeah, where you can feel like you're playing the best 75.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, when you feel like you're, like, being tricked into inbreeding, it's really frustrating, right? Because you know that you're playing a suboptimal deck, but you also know that if you don't do this, you're going to be punished for not playing a suboptimal deck every time you play the mirror.
Exactly. Whereas if I choose something like 4-color Loam, I can be like,
yeah,
well, right. I can do this. Right, like it's.
I feel like this happens a lot with Teemer in Standard right now, right? Like, how many Vizier of Many Faces do you really want in your main deck against Mono Red? Now,
was
how
I
many
talking
do you want?
To you or somebody else about the four Viziers in the sideboard?
Right? Yeah.
It was like definitely too many.
Right, but at the same time, it's like when you're playing the mirror, I'll play six, sure, if they'll let me.
But here's the thing: is like, is one in the main, two in the board too few for the mirror? That's what I mean by, like,
right.
Am I just getting a little too
but there are
far
choices,
in one
right?
direction?
There are trade-offs. Either way, there are trade-offs.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
it's interesting.
So that's it for Legacy this week. That's what we would play. That's a little bit of a look into the metagame. I think that Storm is still relevant in this meta. I think that I personally think that this format looks really prepared for something like Sneak and Show to make an appearance again.
Yeah, I'm interested. Like, the Grixis Delver style matchups, like, obviously if you're playing against less main deck Cabal Therapies, it's not nothing. But,
yeah,
man, I hated that matchup with Sneak and Show.
No, you do. But with them playing less Cabals and I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't matter, though, because Spell Pierce is still kind of a beating.
Yeah, Spell Pierce is going to be really annoying as well. They just have so much interaction. What you really want is for them to be playing Stifle, because Stifle just isn't very good against you.
Sure. Well, let's go on to our next segment, which is our training grounds. We believe if you're not getting better at Magic, you're getting worse. We don't be doing what we can do to improve, which is why we believe in hashtag always improving. And the training grounds is part of that. We want to talk about something that helps us improve as we try and prepare for the week as we do our training grounds. And this week, we want to talk about understanding your sideboard. So, I think that this is something that the patrons were pretty adamant about talking about, as when we posted the poll for what they wanted this episode to be about, sideboarding won by a lot. But I think that the first thing that you have to do before even building a sideboard is understanding what the matchups that you're trying to sideboard for come down to. Like, what is the game about? What axis do you need to try and fight on before you put cards into your sideboard for a given matchup?
Yeah, I think that the one of the other things that sometimes gets people when it comes to this is that sometimes things are different in game one than they are in sideboard. So you can, like, sometimes you could find yourself sideboarding into a deck that feels like it would be a really good game one configuration, but doesn't really make sense once your opponent has access to their sideboard as well. And that's maybe one of the trickiest things about understanding what the matchup is about. Like, it's more complex than just saying, so usually when I lose game one, I lose to this card, so let's play cards that are good against this card.
Yeah, I think that this happens pretty often where, like, you have to understand the holistic view of, like, an individual match. And this is one of the reasons, and we'll get into this in a few parts of the segment, but, like, this is one of the reasons that sideboard guys are a little bit rough for me, because I'm like, well, like, what happens if they, like, suddenly have Ixalan's Binding and you didn't know about it? Are you just going to sit there and, like, have that appetite in your sideboard still? Like, you have to understand, like, if there's a reasonable number of targets, like, what are you bringing in? Why is this card in your board if it's not for this situation? And knowing, like, what axis am I trying to fight on? And I think that the part that you're talking about gets into pretty important parts of the sideboarding conversation once you understand if you're on the player that draw two.
Yeah, I think maybe just understanding that, like, the matches become a little complex after sideboarding frequently just because you both can change the complexion of your deck, like, kind of a lot. And, like, the play-draw configurations obviously factor into that as well.
Let's go on to the next part of this, which I think is getting the most out of an individual slot. And the two kind of ideas that I have of this is, like, huge swing cards, like things like Creeping Corrosion or Shatterstorm or River's Rebuke, versus cards like a Braid, like as a sideboard card, where it's, like, kind of versatile. You can bring it in multiple matchups. Maybe something like Negator Duress. Like, how do you value individual slots, and how do you pick those kind of cards that maybe are big swing cards, like Creeping Corrosion, or maybe are more individualized, like Duress?
Well, the or trick versatile, is, I should say. I guess the trick that I like to think of a lot of the time is, rather than thinking about, like, trying to put as many cards in your sideboard as possible for matchups, trying to think about what you really need to cut in matchups. And that sort of gives you an idea of whether or not you're looking at, like, a few slots for a matchup where you might feel like you need more haymaker cards if that matchup is important to you to really change the percentages. Or a lot of the time, you know, if you're able to trim more cards, you can have a lot of marginal upgrades and sort of make a big impact in the matchup in the same way. So sometimes if you have cards that are versatile across multiple matchups, you can end up, like, with less matchups where you're going to see hugely dramatic swings, but a lot of matchups where you can just dramatically improve what your deck looks like in the boarded games, even if you're still playing a relatively similar game plan.
I want to talk about my sideboard for this weekend, because while I didn't do well this weekend, I thought my sideboard was actually quite amazing. Like, as far as, like, sideboards I've played, I think it might be the best sideboard I've ever played in an event. And I want to talk about a few cards and their identity, specifically to getting the most out of the slot. So early on in testing for this weekend, I played a lot of Yeheni's Expertise. And what I realized is that it was making me play awkwardly against things like Mono Red, and that I was trying to bring it in against tokens, and, like, maybe there were better cards against Mono Red and better cards against tokens that I could play individual slots of. So I cut the two Yeheni's Expertise and played a Die Young and a River's Rebuke. And what this did for me is it allowed me to bring in River's Rebuke against the Mirror, against Teemer, against tokens, against things like that. Dai Young was able to come against the Mirror and against aggro and things like that. It diversified my sideboard in a different way than Yeheni's, which is like this linear card that's very good in certain matchups. But in the way that Mono Red is built, it actually isn't as good in that matchup. And I think that what happens to a lot of Magic players is they get caught up in that part. And that Wraths are good against X, or removal spells are good against X, rather than understanding what the individual matchup is about and what those swing cards can mean. Whereas, like, if you look at a card like River's Rebuke, that first one that you draw against tokens can often end the game.
Right. Whereas, so although it's it's basically a more polarized version of Yanni's expertise, right? You can't cite it in as often, but when you do cite it in, it's much more powerful.
Right. And what happened is, in testing, after I switched, it was like, oh, okay. So Yanni's expertise was better against the two matchups I wanted it, but I would rather have a polarizing card in each matchup rather than a card that's versatile in each matchup. And that could be true about those matchups, but that's understanding what those matchups are about before you decide your sideboard cards. Whereas you could have cards like Cartouche of Ambition that are very specific as to when you want to bring them in, but they're also very good in those matchups.
I think that's true. I think kind of looking at like the next part of this, so like understanding your plans, like what you're sideboarding and why. So I played a bunch of Deathgorge Scavengers in my sideboard this weekend, and they come in a bunch of different matchups. So Deathgorge Scavenger is my favorite sideboard card in this format by a lot. So against Mono Red, I was boarding in two Chandra's Defeats and three Deathgorge Scavengers and cutting two Rogue Refiners, an Essence Scatter, a Vraska, and a that might be the enough cards. Something like that. So but the point of this basically is that in that matchup I wanted to replace Rogue Refiner to like not have too many things that died to shock in my deck.
Sure.
Or two damage spells. But against control, it's entirely possible that I would stick with all four Rogue Refiners and trim on Whirlers or Hostage Takers instead, because the reasons for like why the card was good or how it lined up against the spells in my opponent's deck was really different, right? So like against Mono Red, I felt like it was important not to have too many X2s, because a draw with a ton of X2s could end up being really randomly weak to like Earthshaker, Kenras, and Double Shock or something like that. But in other matchups where that isn't one of the critical factors, you might say, so in Mono Red, Deathgorge Scavenger is a life gain card. Against Control, Deathgorge Scavenger is there to help keep Search for his Kanto from flipping, weaken Torrential Gearhulks, be a four-power attacker, sometimes weaken their Scarab God if it looks like they're going to land one. So you just have like the same card playing very different roles in very different matchups, and even more than the card playing different roles, the things that you're trying to like, things that might be pitfalls for your deck. Against Mono Red, you might say, okay, I don't want too many two toughness creatures. But against Control, you might be saying, I don't want too many creatures that aren't generating me some sort of effect when they come into play. I don't want too many creatures that don't do something sort of like a two for one. And right. I think that like trying to figure out cards that have utility across multiple matchups. So like a single Deathgorge Scavenger against Mono Red isn't just going to end the game.
It just doesn't matter. And this is, I think, that what happens so often in like when you look at like modern sideboard cards, right?
Like don't always have Stony Silence, right? This isn't
exactly.
You don't always get Stony Silence. So sometimes you have to find cards that are more, they're less powerful, but they're more flexible.
Right. And sometimes you find that sweet spot, right? So like if you look at a card like maybe Ancient Grudge, that's good in multiple matchups, right? Like you are like, all right, my deck has a really tough time against something like the deck you won the RPTQ with.
Sure. Lantern.
So, like, Ancient Grudge becomes a little bit better. And then also, because I get to freely play Ancient Grudge to help this bad matchup, it's really good against Affinity. And, like, understanding what, like, those free upgrades are versus, like, a very defined upgrade. So, for example, in Modern right now, I'm playing four Leyline the white Leylines in my Naya Scapeship deck. And I'm literally playing white so that I can play this card to the most effect in my sideboard. And part of that is understanding like what certain matchups are about. Like, how does Storm beat me? Why are they good against me? And then also understanding like, okay, how is Jund trying to beat me? And can this card that's huge impact against a very bad matchup also be impactful against like a decent matchup? And trying to get versatility from your big swing cards is the most powerful plan.
Sure. And then I think understanding why those cards might be better in some decks than others, right? So, like, Leyline is probably a pretty good card against Storm for Scapeshift, but it's probably not a very good card against Storm for blue-white control.
Oh, absolutely.
And understanding why that is, right? So, like, if you can't put a clock on your opponent, forcing them to find a bounce spell doesn't really do anything, right? If they just have to find a wipe away by turn 23, they're probably capable of doing that. Now, if they have to find a wipe away by turn 5, it's kind of a different story. So I think maybe understanding that, like, cards are can only really be viewed through the context of the deck that you're playing and the matchup you're playing them in. So, like, even though you might think, you know, like, Leyline might end up being better against Death Shadow than Jund, because keeping Death Shadow from able to cast its Thoughtseizes, like, affects them in two ways, right? So there's like all this kind of stuff where you just have to try to fully consider what cards do in matchups and understand that, like, just because a card was good for you before doesn't necessarily mean it will be again.
I actually want to talk really quick about something that I'm really passionate about, and that's sideboard guides. So I love our listeners. I love Magic players in general, but I hate getting asked for a sideboard guide. And I've talked about this on the podcast. I've talked about this in videos. And the reason I hate it is because I don't actually think it helps usually. So unless you are quite good at Magic and the sideboard information is literally telling you what the matchup is about, and then you can agree or disagree with the sideboard guide on your own and make decisions going forward and write your own sideboard guide after you see that, I think that they're usually pretty useless.
I think that the main thing is that when decks aren't especially linear, like when decks are more mid-rangey, there are often multiple ways to approach matchups. And a lot more of it is about preference and sort of committing to playing it the way you like to play it.
Yep.
And basically that if you're trying to play a matchup your way with someone else's ideas about sideboarding, it's just not necessarily as helpful as you wish it was.
Unless you're trying to understand how they think the matchup should be approached, right?
But that's different than just saying, hey, I need a sideboard deck so I can play my event this weekend.
Exactly. And I think that that's like the key difference is understanding what their plan is might help you define your plan. But if your goal is just to get a guide and go forward, it's actually not that helpful for you. Because unless you're specifically questioning that guide and understanding what you're trying to get out of it, what is it actually doing for you?
Right. Well, and it just the games are more complex than just playing the cards in your hand, right? Like, my record against Mono Red has been very good, but it's because I think it's largely because I've mostly decided to just almost unequivocally ignore Harsh Mentors. I almost never kill them because they just can't attack, and try to hold all my removal spells for Hazarets and Rampaging Ferocidons, which in turn makes my Death Gorge Scavengers better. But, like, if someone else was firing off those removal spells a little quicker and their opponent more frequently had Rampaging Ferocidon in play, then, like, maybe Deathgorge Scavenger wouldn't be as impressive in that matchup. And it's not always, like, one is right and one is wrong, but if you're not playing to the same line that I'm playing to, it's really hard to take the sideboarding advice that I give and apply it.
Right, because the guide itself doesn't tell you the thing that you just said.
Right.
It just gives you an overarching view of your plan in each matchup. So if you want a guide, that's awesome. But you need to question the guide and understand why people are doing what they're doing.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I think ultimately, like, we say this a lot, but I think it's better to have a plan that's suboptimal than it is to have, like, the best sideboard guide but no plan. Like, you just want to know what you're trying to do.
No, this is really important to, like, my weekend this weekend, I really had wished I had a third Deathgorge Scavenger. Not, but I had two, and I was like, oh, this is enough. But, like, as I was, like, boarding in, I was like, man, like, this is the best card in this matchup by a lot. And I really wish that I had done more to try and push this card in. And I really looked at my sideboard guide and realized how many matchups I was bringing it in, why I was bringing it in. Maybe I would have played as many as two Rivers Rebuke. Maybe I would have played as many as three Deathgorge Scavengers. Just trying to understand, like, what am I trying to do? Why is this card important, and what is it coming in for? And I think that a huge part of that is, like, why do you bring in the number of cards that you bring in, and what does that card do to the matchup?
Yeah, and I think I think just having a little experience and like trying to play the matchups a little bit. So what happens when you win? What happens when you lose? Like, I had anticipated before the Pro Tour that Gonti would be very good against Teemer, but the more I played the matchup, the more it kept dying to Chandra and Glorybringer without actually being able to, you know, trade with anything.
Value, sure.
So, although I think that it looks like Hostage Taker should be worse there, it ended up being a lot better for me in that matchup this weekend. Because I knew what I wanted to do with it.
Yes.
I knew what I wanted to do with it. And I think that, like, whether or not Gonti is better than Hostage Taker in that matchup, it wasn't better the way that I was able to play the matchup.
I think that when you think about something like Hostage Taker, this is a really good point for my weekend, too, where going into it, I was like, okay, so I made the decisions I made on my deck list because I didn't want to be a Hostage Taker deck. But I did think I was short one Hostage Taker. Before I even started the event, I was like, man, like if I ended up playing some mirrors or against mono red, like my matchup gets significantly worse with the less Hostage Takers I'm playing, and I'm only playing one. And knowing that going into event does actually help me build my sideboard. I made my mono red matchup and my mirror match worse by not playing as many Hostage Takers. And knowing that actually does help me build my sideboard, but I have to know what that matchup is about.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, basically, it's about, like, being cohesive, right? That, like, your sideboard plan and your game plan have to sort of be in sync.
Yeah. Coming up next, we have Game 3, Understanding If You're on the Player of the Draw. The number of times that my opponents don't know the difference between being on the play and the draw, especially in the world of Long Tusk Cub, is really weird to me.
Yeah, I played against a lot of Long Tusk Cubs when my opponents were on the draw, and it always kind of surprised me. So, I mean, there's obviously, like, I can appreciate that there's difference of opinion there, but I had thought that one was a little more cut and dry than it was, and it didn't seem to play out that way over the course of the weekend, to the point that I started changing how I was sideboarding during the middle of the event.
I often would, like, even on MTGO, I was sideboarding completely differently on the play or the draw with my bug deck, because, like, when you're on the play, you want all of your two drops, and when you're on the draw, you either want Long Tusk Cub as a defense play, or you don't want any Windsleeve Siphoner. So it kind of just depends.
But it depends. Some decks care way more about that than other decks, too. Like, in your approach deck, your play versus draw sideboarding is probably
non-existent. Yeah. But when you're looking at a deck with, like, maybe Long Tusk Cub or Windsleeve Siphoner, or even things like Mono Red, it's like, what do I...
always wonder, does anyone cut Bomat Courier on the draw? Ever?
I don't think anybody cuts Bomat Courier at all right now.
But it's so bad on the draw. Every time you're on the draw, that card is embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure it's correct, but, like, that card was brutal against me on the play and never did anything on the draw.
If you get to play it on turn one, though, even on the draw, I think that a lot of the time they're happy enough.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's, like, obviously, it's only really good on turn one ever. It's good on turn one and turn, you know, 25. That's about it. But just because it's a redraw, right?
Probably
but,
not turn 25.
Well, it redraws, right? It always redraws.
Sure.
So,
but how do you deal with this when you're thinking about your sideboard plan going into event? Do you write these thoughts down? Like, what is my deck trying to do on the play? What is it trying to do on the draw? And why is it trying to do those things?
Sometimes, I mean, if you've played a matchup enough times, it's more about having a feel, right? Like,
Manny's saying hi to me, everybody.
It's more about having a feel for, like, when you get, you know. So, like, one of the interesting decisions for me is how many fatal pushes I keep in play on draw versus Teemer. So you're probably cutting some number, but then, you know, like, Danny and I talked a lot about maybe siding in Chandra's defeat kind of in that slot sometimes.
Sure.
Or, like, siding out the Essence Scatter and keeping in an extra Fatal Push of Chandra's Defeat. And, like, Chandra's Defeat is a lot better as the game goes on, but if your opponent just actually plays a Long Tusk Cub on two when you're on the draw and you're holding a Chandra's Defeat and not a Fatal Push,
yeah,
you tend to, you know, you kind of sometimes it just costs you.
It feels awkward. It feels bad.
There's always trade-offs, right? And it's like it's almost never like just strictly one is correct and one is incorrect. You're sort of trying to feel out how your opponent feels at the same time. And by the time you've played two games against them, hopefully you have an idea of how they're trying to play the matchup, how you think they're going to sideboard against you.
Yeah. I think that too often we get caught up in a guide or something that just shouldn't matter as much as we make it up out to be. A good look at this is like I wrote a sideboard guide out for my event, and I realized when I was following my sideboard guide, I was like, why am I boarding out this push? Like, I'm on the draw, I'm against teamer. If I board out this push and they resolve a cub, like, I'm in trouble. And you need to be able to make a switch. Like, understand, like, what am I not understanding? What am I doing wrong here?
Yeah, I would say this is one of the other kind of dangers of sideboard guides. You can get a little bit too rigid, and sometimes you need to be able to make a weird play. Like, if you think your opponent is going to trim fatal pushes, it might be correct to have long tusk cubs, even against black decks. I sided Essence Scatter out in game 2 against Corey Burkhardt playing blue-white cycling, then sided it back in game 3 and Essence Scattered a Torrential Gearhulk that really blindsided him. And, like, you know, how good is Essence Scatter in that matchup, really? It's probably not great. But I think sometimes you need to be okay with having, like, situational cards in your deck for one reason or another. And it's just something you need a comfort level with. I really think sideboarding is more of an art than a science.
No, and I think so too. And I think that, like, the thing that we preach the most on the show is, like, having a bad plan is better than having no plan. And I really do think that's true. I think that, like, it's pretty easy to get caught up in, like, what I'm trying to do versus, like, or what somebody told me to do versus what the matchup is about, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess what I would really say is kind of trust yourself, right? Like, you're the one who has to play the matches. You're the one who has to live with your choices, live with your deck selection, live with your sideboard slots, and live with your play. So, like, if your friend or someone who you think is better than you wants you to do one thing and you just don't agree with that, there's nothing wrong with doing it your way until either you're proven right or wrong, right? Like, the good thing is, for better or worse, you're going to find out whether your plan was good or not, and then you evaluate and you move forward. That's all you can do.
Yeah. I think that what we really learned in this is, like, don't take cyber guides too seriously. Try and understand them. Understand, like, what your slots are for, right? Like, maybe you have a swing slot. Maybe you have a versatile slot. Understand, like, what the matchup is about before you try and even decide what cards to put in your sideboard. It's really easy to say, like, well, I need X cards to this matchup because there's X bad cards. But, like, you need to make sure that you're upgrading. Make sure that you know what the matchup is about and why you're doing what you're doing. So I think that's it for this week. Don't forget to check out patreon.com/ccmtg. Become a patron of the show, starting at $1 a month. Anything you see fit is really appreciated. You can also check out the other patrons for this network, whether it's Easy Game Media or Limited Time Only. Both of them have Patreons. We appreciate everything. You can find us on Twitter at CCMPG, or you can find us on Facebook by just liking us, the Constructive Criticism page, or find us on the Constructive Criticism family. If you're a patron of $5 or more per month, you can join the Constructive Critics group, or you can find Michael at Magic Mike MPG, or me at Spencer13H. You can find Mason at SOV Mason because he doesn't love us and doesn't want to change his Twitter handle to something, you know, that has to do with Magic the Gathering. You can also join the Discord channel. So I'm trying to be more active. It's a little bit hard right now, but I would love to get the Discord group going. You can join the clan by messaging me at Spencer13Dev or Quentin at Earthstripe. It's URTHSTYRPE. You can also tweet us with hashtag Would That Be Good. Hashtag Would That Be Good is our Twitter outreach for him. If you tweet it, we'll read it, as Michael likes me to say. And let's go to it's the 20th. So, wow, we have to go back a while.
Let me get this pulled up as well.
Literally, yes, just banned from the at CCMTG chat for speaking the truth. Hashtag ban Swift. Hashtag would it be good. So last week, I've definitely never banned anybody from the CCMD chat. I did mute Andrew for being a butthead and just talking mad crap on Taylor. But I've never banned anybody. So hashtag fake.
Shout out to Andrew. Shout out to Andrew.
Mason says, I can now convert my time to Mountain Standard Time without thinking about it. Hashtag would be good. Well, you do deal with a lot of people in Mountain Standard Time,
man. Yeah, but, man, I'm gonna try to get my girlfriend to talk to you because she does not understand time zones.
Got domed for lethal by my opponent's combustible gear hulk hitting 18 off the top. Hashtag would be good. That does seem
that just
powerful.
Sounds great. I'm in for that. Like, you know, hopefully not in game three of a match I care about, but like, I'm in for losing like that. That sounds amusing.
Yeah, it looks like Andrew tweeted about hashtag would be good for the last two his last two tweets. So Mason and Andrew got to commentate the LCQ for their RPDQ, which they both top aided. So congratulations to them. Speaking of which, Andrew says lost in the top of that RPDQ. Heartbreaking, choked back tears, but I played well, and my opponent played awesome. Hashtag PT Dom is next. Time to focus on sealed. Hashtag always improving. Hashtag would be good. That's a good way to look at it. It's really tough to lose in any PDQ final situation. I know that I've lost a win in for top eight where my deck was very well positioned in RPDQ, as well as losing in the finals of a PDQ, as well as losing in the finals of a Sunday Super Series. As like, it's not a good feeling. Like, I remember a conversation.
It just happens.
I remember a conversation with my mother where she's like, "You seem really depressed," and I was like, "You can't possibly understand how I feel right now." Like, I was a turn away from going to the Pro Tour. I can't explain it. And Michael and I have both been there. We understand what you're going through, Andrew. Just keep that attitude and keep going.
Yep. All you can do is keep trying to get better. It really is what it is.
Lonnie says, took down my PPDQ with Jabberwock because you blacklist. Hashtag would be good. I actually think that list is really bad.
I do too. I think it's the deck I played for people who are scared.
Yeah, I think that like the Grixis list from the first Reg Nation is better. I think that four colors better. Like, I just don't actually see a reason to be playing that deck.
Yeah.
You are a MTG nerd when your phone autocorrects dating to Death Gorger. Hashtag would be good. Yeah, that seems like
that sounds disturbingly like my phone. I have some weird autocorrects. All I will say is, like, if I start typing numbers, my phone just starts guessing cards. Like, if I type, like, 1, 2, 3, or 4 in a text message, its next prediction is always, like, magic card. They'll give me 3 different choices sometimes that are all magic cards. I'm like, oh, man.
Next up, we have Jared, who says, that's fair. My main concern with this deck is the mana.
Oh, yeah,
I feel like another...
Yeah, this is, like, part of a conversation I was having with Jared that he hashtagged at the end. So he's talking about maybe cutting a Scarab God or a Hostage Taker for another land in the list I play with GP. I basically said I wouldn't do it, but, you know, I haven't tested it like that either, so knock yourself out.
Podcasting is life, hashtag with good at CCMDG, who hooked my Instagram. Honestly, I met a ton of listeners this weekend, gave out, I think, like 11 wristbands. Like, it was a good weekend for me, despite the fact that, you know, I didn't do as well as I wanted to in the event. But I really appreciate the listeners of this show and talking to me and telling me about how the show's improved their life. I had multiple people come up and say that we've inspired them to do Magic content, to do things like that. So thank you to all of you. So days after, I admit that Taylor Swift's music has a good beat. I go undefeated in the RPGU until the final round. Coincidence? God, I hope so. Hashtag, would that be good? I don't know what to tell you, man. I think that Taylor Swift is literally the best songwriter outside of Ed Sheeran of our generation. And they're only followed by Kesha up next. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And Michael Smile, we'll see you guys all next week.
See you guys.